This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning into The Record. If you have a baby or a medical emergency, you can take time off. You just might not get paid for it. A few states make private employers pay their workers for family or emergency leave. Washington is not one of them. That might be about to change, though. State legislators, Democratic and Republican, are sponsoring paid leave bills in Olympia. Republican Senator Joe Fain of Auburn, welcome to KUOW.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is the first time you've sponsored paid family leave in the legislature. Why now?
Well, I had a kid last year, and my wife and I have a great situation with family support and a lot of help and good jobs, and we're exhausted. So think about some of those families that haven't been as fortunate as I, and they need support, and families should be kept together at that very formative time in a new child's life, or at those important times when other family members are facing health problems or other family emergencies.
All the lobbying people have done in Olympia over the years, it got real for you when you had your own child?
It does get real when you've got your own family situation that you get to relate the whole issue to.
On the Democratic side, the sponsor of the Democrat version of paid family emergency leave said that when Washington voters passed initiatives for paid sick leave and higher minimum wage, that's when the Washington business community thought, maybe we can get a better paid family leave deal in the legislature than on a ballot. Do you think that played in?
I think in general you get more thoughtful legislation that takes into account all of the complexities of big issues like this. When you are able to work it through the legislative process, sometimes an initiative can be a real blunt instrument. But there's no question that the idea that there could be an initiative on this topic in the future certainly does provide some motivation to folks to look a little bit harder at this issue.
And you also have the city of Seattle possibly passing their own version. The theory I'd heard is that you could either say, well, Seattle's going to go farther than we want with paid family emergency leave, or just that we don't want to deal with a patchwork of it's the law in this city this way, in this place, someplace else, and that's a headache for businesses too.
The patchwork is a real problem for businesses. We've seen that on a lot of different issues, not just on the concept of paid family leave. And so having a state system does provide not only a large pool of individuals to be able to have a sustainable, basically, market for paid family leave to be paid out of. So there's that benefit. But also it provides predictability for both employers and employees about what kind of benefits they'll be receiving by being a part of this plan.
Well, let's talk about those benefits. There's a Republican version in the House, a Democratic version. What is the difference between the benefits and the pay level that you're offering versus the Democrats?
Well, there's been a lot of talk since both of those pieces of legislation were introduced. And in fact, the most recent paid family leave piece of legislation that was introduced was actually a bipartisan piece of legislation by myself and Senator Karen Kaiser from the Kent-Des Moines area. And that's basically a placeholder bill that if we're able to find common ground and we're able to get something done, then we'll be able to use that as a vehicle to send this thing to the governor's desk. But the primary differences and the discussion points that we've been having, some of them are obvious, some of them are a little bit more technical. How many weeks of benefit should be provided? What is the share of who pays into the system, employer versus employee? And what are the qualifying family situations that would allow someone to be able to participate and take benefit from that program? And also, how do we treat different employers of different sizes in how they pay into the system and the benefits that those employees can get? So those are all the moving pieces that we're trying to work through in addition to others that are a lot more technical, but certainly just as important.
One big difference that jumps out is you're suggesting 8 weeks of paid leave, and it gets phased in, but the Democratic version I saw is calling for 26 weeks of paid leave. That's quite a difference. Is that Democratic sponsor being too generous with the employer's benefits?
I think that there's a lot of conversation about where we go on that topic, and I think there's a lot of movement on both sides to find a balance that isn't too disruptive to the employer community, but at the same time provides employees the type of leave and predictability that they need, particularly at that important time when a new child's come into their life.
And as you say, we get into how much employees pay versus employers, and at what level of your salary can you leave. over all of this is the fact that the legislature passed paid family leave a decade ago but never funded it, so it's not in effect. First of all, why did that happen?
Well, I think there's a lot of times in the legislature where people really, really like the idea of something, but they don't like having to do what's difficult. And what's always difficult is paying for it. And so we've seen a long history of legislation being put into law and being kicked out so that it doesn't take effect for years and years in the future, or it's not funded. And so we put the structure in place so that we can cut the ribbon and declare victory, but we don't do the necessary and the difficult work of actually funding that promise that we're making to the public. And those are really false promises. And that's why I've been pleased this year that the proposals that have been placed on the table have also come with a funding source, so that they aren't just empty rhetoric, but can be something that really can benefit people in the end.
So you think the state actually would fund paid family and emergency leave, even though the legislature hasn't figured out how to fund basic education? That's such a budget hole.
Well, we've got plans on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers that I think amply fund our McCleary obligations that are on the table right now. I have every expectation that that's going to happen. But the funds that are necessary to fund a paid family leave program wouldn't be coming from what we call the general fund. It would be similar to our unemployment insurance programs or our labor and industry programs, which are these separate accounts that are funded from the payments that are made by employers or employees that pay into the system. And so that's where the resources would come to help this system function, so that that they're not in conflict or in competition for funds from our schools.
Finally, as you said, there's negotiating moving pieces happening right now. How optimistic are you that some kind of paid family leave and emergency leave plan is going to pass in this session?
Well, I'm going to stay really optimistic. I've put a lot of time into this issue. I've been really appreciative of the level of interest from both the business community, the labor community, Democrats in the House and in the Senate, as well as some of my colleagues in the Senate as well. And so I'm going to stay optimistic and hope that we can get this done.
Republican Senator Joe Fain of Auburn, good to talk with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Bill.
Joe Fain of Auburn is working on a bill to require employers to pay workers who take family or sick leave. There's also a Democratic bill proposing paid family leave. And here in Seattle, City Council member Lorena Gonzalez wants a backup plan in case the state legislature doesn't pass paid leave. Today, she proposed giving employees, private employers, would have to pay 26 weeks of paid leave to bond with their child or care for a sick relative. Okay, let's go back down to Olympia now, where state lawmakers are figuring out their budget. In the Senate Republican version, it is education and mental health that get top billing. But it's what Republicans don't fund that's getting a lot of pushback from Democrats. Here's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins.
Senate Republicans introduced their budget in the ornate state reception room in the Capitol.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us here today.
This was Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler, who tried to distance himself from the national political scene.
And despite all of the rhetoric about the other Washington, we've stayed focused on what's most important to residents in this Washington.
He said the Senate Republican budget makes an unprecedented investment in education. Specifically, it calls for nearly $2 billion more in state funding for K-12 over the next 2 years, funded in part by a new state property tax levy that would replace local levies. Remember, the state of Washington is in contempt of court over school funding and has until next year to solve the problem. Senate Budget Chair John Braun called this a historic year.
And if we get this right, and I believe we have, the decisions we make in this budget will have a positive impact on the state of Washington this year and for decades into the future.
Along with more money for K-12, Washington's four-year universities would get funding to create nearly 2,000 new resident student slots. In mental health, the Senate budget would begin to fund a 10-year transition away from state hospital-based treatment to community-based treatment, something Democratic Governor Jay Inslee has also proposed. Again, Senator Braun.
This is both the humane thing to do and the fiscally responsible thing to do.
Overall, Republicans would spend $43 billion over the next 2 years. That's a $5 billion increase over current state spending. But Inslee, at his own news conference, said it's not enough.
It does not amply fund education. This is only a marginal education budget at best.
In December, Inslee proposed a $46.5 billion spending plan. It included a new proposed tax on capital gains and a new carbon tax. Inslee said he still prefers that approach to the Senate Republicans' reliance on the property tax.
I do not believe raising property taxes is the way to go about funding education.
Inslee also criticized the Senate Republican budget for not funding collective bargaining agreements he negotiated with state employee unions. Instead, Republicans would give state workers an across-the-board $1,000 pay raise. Collective bargaining contracts for state troopers and prison workers would get funding. Braun, the budget chair, said he believes the contracts the governor negotiated are too generous.
We ask, are they truly necessary? Result in nearly half the state employees receiving double-digit pay increases.
Democrats in the legislature were quick to criticize the Republican budget for cuts to the social safety net. State Senator Kevin Ranker is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Budget Committee. He decried several cuts, including the elimination of the Housing and Essential Needs Program for people who are incapacitated and unable to work for at least 90 days.
I believe that this budget disproportionately impacts some of the neediest in our state.
The leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus went even further, calling the Republican budget cold-blooded.
Well, it's unfortunate that that's their talking point.
Budget Chair John Braun defended his approach and challenged Democrats to actually pass the taxes they believe are necessary.
Otherwise, they're not serious. They're not serious about getting done, and we are serious.
Majority Democrats in the Washington House are expected to unveil their budget next week. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
On the Muckleshoot Reservation near Auburn, there's a house with bullet holes in the side and candles clustered in the front yard. King County deputies went there last fall to check on a pregnant woman who was sending suicidal messages. Her family wants to know whether deputies followed their training for dealing with people in mental health crisis. That will be part of an inquest in May. In part one of this story, KUOW's Amy Radel reports on events leading to the death of Renee Davis.
Renee Davis's family remembers the 23-year-old as a young mother, a sweet-natured person who was a domestic violence survivor, a hunter, someone with a history of depression.
Growing up in foster homes, no matter how great they may be, is never easy.
That's Davis's foster sister, Danielle Bargala. Both Davis and Bargala are Muckleshoot tribal members. Bargala's parents took Renee Davis into their home when both girls were in elementary school. Standing near a playground on the reservation southeast of Auburn, Bargala says she and her new sister were furious rivals who grew closer as they grew up.
I mean, honestly, when we were young, we used to fight all the time, like fists. I would always tease her, like a couple years ago, like, remember when I used to beat you up?
But Bargala says for foster children like Davis, the hardest struggles were internal.
At the end of the day, we're not their mom and we're not their dad, and they're searching for that kind of love that comes from a parent and wondering why their parents aren't there.
Bargala says as a young adult, Davis tried to be self-sufficient while raising three young daughters, but she battled depression and was hospitalized for it. Last October 21st, she and Bargala had exchanged texts saying hi and making plans. As the night went on, though, Davis was sending darker messages.
And I think she definitely had her struggles with suicidal thoughts, and she always reached out to somebody. And she did. She did reach out to people that night.
Davis texted her boyfriend, "Come get the girls or call 911. I'm about to shoot myself." Her boyfriend approached King County Deputy Nicholas Pritchett, who was assigned to the Muckleshoot Reservation, and asked him to check on Davis. He informed Pritchett that Davis did have access to guns. Bree Blackhorse is an attorney for Davis's family.
Now, this particular deputy had served on the reservation for approximately 7 years. He knew Renee personally. He had responded to about a half dozen incidents involving her where she was the victim of domestic violence, and he knew of no violent history involving Renee.
Another King County deputy, Tim Lewis, was in the area and came to provide backup. The sheriff's office says it would not be appropriate to discuss this case until after the inquest, but it says both deputies had received an 8-hour course in crisis intervention. Sergeant Tony Lockhart coordinates that training for King County law enforcement. He says he can't discuss this particular case. In general, Lockhart says officers learn that sometimes it's okay to back off when someone may be suicidal. But if the person has a weapon and other people are present, officers have fewer options.
We've got to make that scene safe. So I can't de-escalate and use some of these techniques and tactics that we use if it's a volatile, rapid evolving situation.
That night last October, two of Davis's daughters, then ages 2 and 3, were home with her. Danielle Bargallo was driving home to visit her parents who live nearby. When she pulled in, she knew something was wrong.
And I could hear my sister Melody on the porch. And she was saying just like questions like, really, by who? When? Okay, Danny just pulled in, I'm on my way. And then my niece Angel came out of the house and she was like sobbing and she had the phone in her hand and she handed it to me and it was my mom. And she said, Danny Renee's been shot and she didn't make it.
Bargallo says they would only see confirmation of how Davis died later that night on television, and they're still seeking answers. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and tomorrow we're going to have the second part of our story about the questions surrounding the death of Renee Davis. KUOW Seattle, good to have you here on The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Public bathrooms and transgender rights. The whole country's been arguing over that lately. And here in Washington, a group called Just Want Privacy is collecting signatures to overturn a state law that lets trans people use the bathroom of their choice. Just Want Privacy says this is all about protecting women. Our next guest now says that idea of protecting women in public bathrooms showed up about a century ago in this country when the first public bathrooms for women were built. She says the idea comes from Victorian tradition, along with some junk science. Shannon Keating is the LGBT editor at BuzzFeed. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What is the connection between building public bathrooms for women and protecting women?
So the first public bathrooms for women were mandated by law in Massachusetts in 1887. And by 1920, 43 other states had joined. And the reason that those laws were originally on the books was because of those laws were aimed at factories, which was a result of social anxieties over women leaving the home and joining the workforce. And they were those elements combined with panic over the spread of disease, and also the Victorian preoccupation at that time with modesty and privacy. So these laws were meant to protect women at the same time that evolutionary biologists were kind of peddling the theory that women were mentally and physically inferior. So the separated bathrooms was supposed to keep women in their own safe little spaces away from the world of men.
You mentioned Victorian preoccupations and junk science, but people have been separating men and women for thousands of years, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure, of course. But this separation particularly came about because, especially for public spaces built for the middle and upper classes, those worlds were built for men. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily a question of separation from the get-go. It was a question of, these were spaces that were built for men. How are we going to retroactively fit women into these spaces?
The argument against letting trans people use bathrooms that are consistent with their gender identity is that men are going to claim gender identity as a reason to go into women's restrooms, and then they're going to leer at women or they're going to assault them. And you say this is not a new argument.
No, it's definitely not a new argument. There's always been a kind of boogeyman in the bathroom since the beginning of gender-segregated bathrooms. During the Civil Rights Movement, the argument that black men would prey on white women in bathrooms was a popular argument for not desegregating public bathrooms.
And you also point out that the bathroom, I hadn't really thought about this before, but that the bathroom is the site of many a horror movie scene. Have horror films amped up our fears that men are going to attack women in bathrooms?
I think they both amp them up, and they reflect those fears, really. I mean, the bathroom has always been a site of all of our cultural anxieties around power and sex and shame and privacy. And you can see that reflected in a lot of our most famous horror movies. I mean, in the most famous horror scene of all time in Psycho is with a kind of a genderqueer villain attacking a woman with a knife in a shower.
Right.
You've got The Shining when Jack Nicholson is bursting into the door, Nightmare on Elm Street, that famous scene of Freddy Krueger's hand coming up through Nancy's legs. In the bathroom has just always been a site where, especially when it comes to female victimhood, where we kind of lump all of our anxieties around the delicacies of women and possibly being attacked.
And then you get the 80s comedies where men want to sneak into bathrooms and gawk.
Yes, the sneaking in and gawking, imagining what's going on the other side of the bathroom. And it's interesting because in those 80s movies, that's kind of seen like, oh, you expect that boys would want to see what's going on in the other bathroom. When it's straight boys kind of fantasy, that's just like, oh, boys will be boys. But then on the flip side, when you have these horror films, when you have this more kind of like the queer deviant that's monstrous, you can kind of see that link to now the idea of the trans predator who, for whatever reason, we consider to be far scarier than the more normalized idea of straight men imagining what's going on in women's bathrooms.
Talking with Shannon Keating, who is the LGBT editor at BuzzFeed, and we've been talking about the history of gender and bathrooms, and let's look to the future, and I suppose it's happening here and there. Do you think gendered bathrooms are on their way out?
I mean, I think we have a long way to go. I think clearly with all of these arguments popping up nationally and with groups who are using trans people as scapegoats and telling them that they shouldn't be allowed to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity means that I don't think that necessarily gender-neutral bathrooms are going to be right around the corner, but plenty of architects and advocates who are advocating for gender-neutral bathrooms aren't just thinking about trans people, even though they are thinking about people of all identities, but an equitable bathroom would also be a place that is accessible to people with disabilities, that's accessible to families. Bathrooms separated by gender have long since been a way that lends a lot of awkwardness and anxiety when it comes to same-sex families trying to take their kids to use the bathroom. There's lots of different ways that throughout the history of gender-segregated bathrooms, they've perpetuated these kinds of inequities. And I don't necessarily think they're going to go away right away because they've always been these sites of anxiety. And trans people are just the latest people to kind of be used as a reason why we shouldn't have gender-neutral bathrooms.
Shannon, have you used gender-neutral bathrooms? And what's your experience? What are they like for you?
I have used gender-neutral bathrooms. I mean, I live in New York City, and a lot of restaurants, more modern restaurants, have gender-neutral bathrooms. And I think a lot of the time when people use them, you don't even really notice it. I think the future in terms of the ideal gender-neutral bathroom is kind of a long bay of stalls that are floor-to-ceiling, so basically a bunch of different single-stall bathrooms all grouped together. And then around a different corner, you maybe have like a bay of sinks. Plenty of people have used these bathrooms without really thinking about it. These are also self-monitoring spaces. Like when you have these arguments about safety, a lot of trans advocates say that gender-neutral bathrooms that are kind of all alone, a single stall far away, can actually be more dangerous as opposed to a public space that's self-monitoring and everyone in public is mixing.
Shannon, I've got 5 sisters and 3 brothers, and I don't give a damn what gender is next to me. Honestly, I don't think of it, but I did a little survey of coworkers, and they brought up things like, well, I don't want to, you know, whatever it is, comb my hair, put on makeup next to other genders. I don't. What about you? the whole tradition of you're out for an evening and you leave your dates at the table, mm-hmm. and you go freshen up with your buddy. What are we losing, if anything, by moving away with the gendered bathroom?
Yeah, I mean that's a good point. They definitely, even though they also carry those kind of like dark anxieties in bathrooms, they've also been a site for kind of community and people coming together. Like especially for women, the bathroom can sometimes be a safe space. But at the end of the day, it's not a safe space for everyone. If you have a butch lesbian, doesn't necessarily feel that sense of community or safety in a bathroom that's filled with women doing their makeup, or for trans women or drag queens or people who are assigned female at birth or assigned male at birth, rather, who use makeup, don't feel safe in the men's bathroom. So gender is such a different experience for all of us that if we only consider the experiences and prioritize the experiences of cisgender people, then you end up kind of leaving out all these people with different gender experiences who are actively harmed by the separation of bathrooms.
I understand that, tell me if I got this right, that when you see a single stall bathroom and there's a men's and a women's, you'll use the men's room.
That is true. I mean, slowly different localities are starting to kind of do away with the law that that gender-neutral single-stall bathrooms should be segregated by gender, but I think that's just the silliest thing in the world. It's just a single room. There's nothing gendered about it necessarily, and it's not hurting anyone. So if there's a really long line for a single-stall women's restroom and there's another unused single-stall men's bathroom, we'll use it.
Okay. You're not bringing in, is it like a little protest? Is that the idea?
I mean, not even a protest, but the other aspect of inequities with bathrooms is that women, for multiple reasons, those bathroom lines can get incredibly clogged, both because there typically are less toilets in a women's bathroom than there are urinals in a men's bathroom, just right. because of space issues. But also because, for biological reasons, cisgender women just tend to take longer in the bathroom. So that leads to, I'm sure you've seen scenes at stadiums or concerts where there's just huge, huge women's lines and like a really short men's line. So when it comes to imagining an equitable bathroom, the idea would be to have two toilets for every urinal or two women's stalls for every men's stall. So I guess you'd call me using a single stall restroom and protest, but I really just think of it in terms of like pure practicality, which right. is, I think, the way we should think about restrooms.
Sorry, urinal manufacturers.
Well, we can still have urinals too, but maybe we just don't necessarily need to gender them.
Right. Okay. I take it you're not wearing flowery Victorian perfume that's going to make the guys come in and say, "I think there's been ladies in my space."
No, I don't. I don't think they'll notice at all, actually.
Okay. Shannon Keating, LGBT editor at BuzzFeed. It's been great talking with you about the history and the present and future of bathrooms and gender. Thanks a lot for this.
You too. Thanks.
It's KUOW's The Record. The small town of Black Diamond is the site of a big housing development. And when we say big, we mean this development that's coming is four times the size of Black Diamond currently. To say the town is divided over this is an understatement. It has nearly broken the Black Diamond government. KUOW's Region of Boom team has been covering the controversy, and as we wrap up our coverage, we want to talk about what the future holds for Black Diamond. Reporter Dennis Box has been covering this development fight for years. Kristen Bryant is a member of Save Black Diamond, a group that tried to stop the development. And Jonna Thompson lives in Black Diamond, and she thinks the development is really going to connect the town.
I think that as Black Diamond grows and as we get improved streets and more sidewalks that are part of the byproduct of the growth, that we'll be able to walk easily from the current library to the new development, the new villages, and where there will be some shopping and a community center and activities happening, like there's going to be a big open area where they're going to be able to have live music and a farmer's market and things that are going to draw people from the downtown corridor into the villages.
Kristen, you are tussling with this development, which is going to happen. The fight went up to the Supreme Court, and the fight was lost there. You can't stop the development, so what are you hoping to do?
So it's a good question. There are, in a development of this size, permit decisions after permit decisions after permit decisions that have come since the fight started, that was the court case that you referred to, and that have come, you know, that are going on right now and will come for the next 10 years. So those kinds of things are going to come up over and over. Schools are going to be a huge issue that are still going to have to be addressed. How are they going to pay for? Is it possible to avoid a huge amount of crowding in schools like we've seen in Snoqualmie and Redmond and the Lake Washington School District, and bonds that fail to pass?
Okay. Kristen is speaking on behalf of constructive argument that, and I want to talk about argument, because these two viewpoints, accepting the development, resisting or improving the development, they're kind of duking it out in the city government, almost literally, actually. Jonna, what's going on there?
Well, let me say that our city council is made up of five people, and there are three people who vote as a block, and they have agreed to support each other, and they vote all the time the same direction. And so what they're really doing is excluding the other two council members, and they don't talk at all with the other two council members. They don't communicate with them outside of the council meetings. They don't try to chat with them. They don't try to ask them their opinion about anything. So the three council members have really isolated themselves from the other two council members. And then the three council members, with one of the things they do is they love to blame the mayor on everything. Everything's the mayor's fault, and that's not true at all. That's not accurate at all.
How would you characterize, Kristen, what's going on the city with the city council and the mayor right now?
The mayor and the two council minority members had been swept up into some misinformation regarding the development and the whole "you can't do anything." But clearly it matters to the developer quite a bit who's on the city council, who's in the mayor's seat, and that says volumes about what the influence of future elected officials really is. And I really think that they have become pro-development. There is a huge problem with you know, not necessarily having that position, although I don't think that it's one that's representative of the town, but with using the instruments of power to then try to embarrass your political opponents by not posting their agendas or information on the website, not letting some council member at a meeting finish a motion. Those instruments of power that the mayor wields with her gavel, with kicking people out of the room, calling recesses that aren't appropriate, that's a real problem no matter which side of the politics you come down on. We can't have a functioning government if basic rules aren't followed.
Dennis, what's your observation? You're sitting in a different chair as a reporter.
You know, so as a writer, one of the interesting things and the things that you try to keep yourself to understand, remember, all of these council members and the mayor were on the same side at one time. In the beginning, they were all on the same side.
And what was that?
Against the development, all of them. And all of them were actively involved, you know, in it appropriately. I'm not, you know, they just were. And as things go along, coalitions change, sides change. You know, it's like politics. Like I said, it's like groups. You know, people change, things change.
And new information comes to light, too, I assume.
Yeah. And for example, you talk about three members of the majority and making a coalition. That's how our government works. It works by groups, coalitions coming together, and, you know, it really aggravates the minority. Ask the Democrats how they feel at the House right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works. And it can be very, very frustrating for either side at times. But, you know, that's kind of the system we have. And those coalitions form and move and change and break. And a lot of times as a reporter, what I'm doing when I'm covering any political entity at all is I'm watching those coalitions change and to see where things will go. because you're always trying to predict that and trying to figure that out. But it's also, that's the function of our government. Our government is about eventually compromise. Coalitions form, compromises get made. When we have trouble in our government is when we cannot compromise.
Jonna and Kristen, on two sides of this development argument, what do you agree on?
Well, I can't speak for Jonna, so...
Well, maybe we can find out right now. What would you guess?
I think that there is a real strong care for maintaining a sense of a rural small community in Black Diamond. I think that people are very, very concerned about school crowding and how can you best handle growth without having the kids all end up in portables for years before you can build schools. I think that there's a desire to protect trees and natural spaces and wildlife. I know that a lot of people have testified about that.
Jonna, school overcrowding, protecting the natural environment. I assume you agree on that.
Well, I agree that a healthy future for Black Diamond is what we want. And that's for a healthy future for the city itself. The city is kind of its own entity, and a healthy future for the people that live there now and for the people who are coming. And within that healthy future, it's everyone being able to enjoy and take advantage of how beautiful it is there and the deer walking through your front yard and friendly people are in the community. So there's some really wonderful things about Black Diamond that we can share with people who are coming in as future residents.
Kristen also mentioned a small community feel. There's a heart of a question, right? Do you still want Black Diamond, as you want it to grow with this development, do you still want it to have a small community feel?
I think that that's part of the design that's going into the villages. It's designed around being a rural community with lots of open space and neighborhood feelings. The schools that have already been planned for in the development are developed around being walkable and being neighborhood within the neighborhood so that families can meet each other. They're also designed at having a capacity of about 400 students, so not mega elementaries, but much smaller, so families actually get a chance to know each other. So that is part of the plan behind the development, is growing small communities that can interact with each other, but also have a connection within themselves.
So yes, small community feel. You said rural, open space. That can be Black Diamond's future.
Correct.
Agreed, Kristen?
So regarding open space, it's really important to know that the developer has about 1,500 acres. Let's say 500 are preserved as open space. Those are almost entirely wetlands and protected wetland buffers, which are lands you cannot develop according to state law. The developer is even putting their trails into those buffers rather than outside of them. They are preserving almost no open space beyond what the state minimum would require.
So to you, Black Diamond will lose its small time. I'm quoting you, small community feel, rural, open space feeling.
I think
that's
it
going
will.
Away.
I think it's hard to imagine any place that could quadruple, that could add 20,000 people to the 4,000 existing and not have a drastic change in feel.
Okay.
That worries me quite a bit.
Dennis, you've seen other communities change and you've listened to this conversation about Black Diamond's future. What do you think?
That's just the word you use, change. It will change. That is correct. It will change.
We can confirm that.
It will change. And generally speaking, I mean, it's sooner or later, people, you know, kind of begin governing. As people move in, other people get on the council, other people do this, other, you know. So communities always change. They're living organisms. They always change. Just like a council. A council is a living organism. It is a group. It's kind of like group therapy, you know, and it's a group and it changes, you know. The political hostility and the tension at the meeting that they're referring to will abate. There will come a time when it will abate, and you'll once again have council meetings where there's two people at it and you know, meet.
Just like the old days.
It'll happen. Yes, they'll come together, and it'll be hard, but eventually they'll figure it out.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, talking about the future of Black Diamond with reporter Dennis Box, who covers the town for the Renton Reporter. And we also heard from Jonna Thompson, a Black Diamond resident, and Kirsten Bryant, a member of the anti-development group Save Black Diamond. And you'll find all our coverage on that town's development argument, conversation that they're having right now. Just go to KUOW.org and you search for Region of Boom. President Trump has made it clear fighting climate change, not a priority for his administration. But it's still a top issue for Democratic governors and lawmakers in Washington and Oregon. There's talk of a cap and trade system in Oregon. In Washington, the idea of a carbon tax keeps popping up. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
Last fall, voters in Washington were asked to enact a first-in-the-nation carbon tax.
We can make polluters pay, reduce carbon pollution, and reduce our sales tax, too.
But Initiative 732 went down to defeat. That didn't stop Washington Governor Jay Inslee a few weeks later from proposing a tax on carbon to help pay for education.
It taxes carbon pollution that harms our kids and imperils the planet.
And just the other day, the Democratic chair of Washington's House Environment Committee held a public hearing on yet another carbon tax proposal.
I think this bill is our best shot at starting to reduce our emissions to a safe level.
In other words, Washington Democrats and their allies in the labor and environmental movements aren't letting go of the idea of a carbon tax. They chalk up last November's defeat to a flawed initiative, not a lack of public support. And they say another attempt at the ballot is likely. Democrat Joe Fitzgibbon chairs the House Environment Committee. He says business leaders have told him they're concerned about a future ballot measure.
And I've told them they should be concerned. I think that's a very likely outcome. I don't think the people of the state want to sit back and wait for the legislature to take action on something that they feel is urgent.
Fitzgibbon says he's tried to craft his proposed carbon tax to address some of the concerns raised by businesses. For instance, industries that use a lot of energy and are trade dependent, like steel recyclers, would get special consideration. But at the public hearing for the bill, it was clear Fitzgibbon had not won them over.
We're here today to speak in opposition.
In strong opposition to this bill.
Speak in opposition.
And we are here today in opposition to House Bill 1646.
There are also provisions in Fitzgibbon's bill that might appeal to Republicans, especially those from rural Washington. Some of the money the tax would raise would go to pay for water infrastructure and forest health projects. But as with the business lobby, so far Republicans aren't persuaded.
You pick winners and losers in a carbon tax.
This is Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler, who's also an Eastern Washington farmer.
As we compete with other states and other countries, we have a carbon tax and they don't. We will lose jobs.
But you get a more nuanced take on a carbon tax from the Republican chair of the Senate Budget Committee. This is State Senator John Braun speaking with me on TVW's Inside Olympia program.
I characterize myself as skeptical. Certainly there's not support right now, and I don't know how that changes in the future. I've said very publicly that I think that, you know, it's been on the ballot once, it'll likely be on the ballot again. We should be talking about it, we should be smart about it, but I don't think it's in our immediate future.
The fact Braun is even open to discussing a carbon tax might reflect the district he represents. It includes the Chehalis River Basin, where flood mitigation, including a new flood-controlled dam, could cost several hundred million dollars. Braun's legislative seatmate, Republican State Representative Richard DeBolt, also signals at least an openness to considering some sort of carbon pricing program.
I think flooding is one of the most important things to the people in my district. If we needed to find a solution for it, I'm willing to look at all solutions.
But even Democrats like House Environment Chair Joe Fitzgibbon are not holding their breath for a grand bargain on a carbon tax this year.
I think it's possible. I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't bank on it at this time, though.
Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler is more blunt. He calls the chances of a carbon tax this year slim and none. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
On KUOW, Seattle, we're following the news out of London. Police there now say 4 people have died, 20 people wounded in what they're calling a terror attack. The 4 dead include an attacker and a police officer who was guarding Parliament. Other victims were on Westminster Bridge, where a car ran down pedestrians. We're going to bring you the latest in less than 10 minutes here on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us today. British Columbia has declared a public health emergency. Almost 1,000 people there died last year from drug overdoses. What to do about it? Well, BC is considering treating addicts in a way that goes farther than any place else in Canada. Here to tell you about it from CBC Radio's On the Coast, Stephen Quinn. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Drug overdose is not one of the 10 leading causes of death here in King County or Washington State. Why has it gotten so bad in British Columbia?
British Columbia and Vancouver in particular has always been a hotbed of illicit drug use and injection drug use. You know, you've got all of the social causes of drug abuse, you know, poverty, sexual abuse. Here with the Aboriginal population, you've got the residential school system. But the downtown east side of Vancouver in particular has always been a magnet because that's where the drugs are. And we've seen this decade after decade. What's changed, and as you said, nearly 1,000 people dead last year, the public health emergency has been in place for almost a year. In fact, the introduction of fentanyl onto the streets is really what's changed things. We've always seen injection drug users using opiates like heroin or injecting cocaine. With the introduction of fentanyl, which is turning up in everything, we're told that heroin has essentially disappeared from the streets here. And fentanyl is so incredibly powerful that addicts don't know what they're taking, and they're overdosing all over the place just this month at the rate of about 1 a day in Vancouver.
Yes, fentanyl use is on the rise in King County as well. It's this synthetic painkiller. It's like morphine, but 50 to 100 times stronger. And what is your province going to do about it, Stephen?
Well, the province would say that they are doing something about it right now. I mean, they've provided additional funding to the health authorities for emergency services. They've launched an information campaign. They've set up a rather unique mobile medical clinic right in the middle of the downtown east side in this empty lot. The mayor of Vancouver, though, is saying, and he said this yesterday, none of that is going far enough. That mobile medical clinic is about to close its doors because of a lack of funding. Mayor Gregor Robertson obviously would like to see it stay open. And he wants the province to expand a program that gives addicts clean prescription opiates like heroin and like hydromorphone. Now, this is already happening on a small scale at a place called the Crosstown Clinic. About 140 people go there a couple of times every day. They inject themselves with heroin that's provided by the clinic, and there are doctors and nurses there overseeing the project. The mayor wants to see that program expanded to accommodate up to 450 people.
And our listeners might know hydromorphone better as Dilaudid, again, stronger than morphine. And what are the reasons for giving heroin or hydromorphone to addicts for free?
A bunch of reasons. It stabilizes their lives, first off. I mean, if you talk to any addict at all, especially those who are involved in the program, you know, they'll tell you that before they were enrolled in that program, they'd spend their days and nights looking for a fix. It reduces petty crime. You know, I walk to work in the morning through a neighborhood where I'll routinely pass 4 or 5 cars that have got their windows smashed out, often by addicts who are looking for anything of value that they can sell to pay for drugs. You've got the survival sex trade. Women are doing sex work for drug money. It also puts drug users in touch with those doctors and nurses I mentioned who can look after other concerns, you know, their mental health in particular. And the drug users tell me that it takes away a lot of the stigma of being a drug user because it officializes it, it medicalizes it instead of it being seen as a criminal activity. And obviously the strain on emergency services here, police, paramedics, they don't have to spend all of their time dealing with overdose victims.
Well, those are the benefits, Stephen, but I can't think that the phrase free heroin is a winning slogan with everyone. How are politicians and the public reacting to that?
You would be right. Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that this works. There were all kinds of trials before the Crosstown Clinic opened its doors. It's all peer-reviewed. The mayor's certainly in favor. You do see opposition from politicians who say that there's too much attention being paid to the harm reduction end of this. and not enough attention paid to the other pillars of what was always supposed to be this four-pillar strategy. It's supposed to include prevention and treatment. That doesn't get nearly as much attention as harm reduction does. Drug enforcement as well, stopping the drugs from getting here in the first place. And yeah, people have a problem with using taxpayers' dollars to provide drugs to addicts. You know, there's an ideological hurdle that people just can't get over, even though the evidence is there that it saves money, it saves lives. But you get people wondering aloud why we're out there trying to save people who are apparently, you know, bent on killing themselves.
We have a minute and a half left with you, Stephen. On balance, then, do you think the any pushback is going to stop this free opioid proposal?
You know, this is one of those things that it needs all levels of government involved. The federal government, because you're talking about what are illegal drugs, you know, heroin and Dilaudid, you know, and you're talking about an activity that is by itself illegal, the federal government has had to essentially give waivers to all programs like this. So ultimately, it's up to them about whether they're going to regulate it, but somebody's got to pay for it as well. Again, in the long run, you end up saving a lot of money by not having to revive addicts, taking the strain off emergency services, not dealing with petty crime, all of that stuff. The mayor is talking about a fairly significant expansion of the program. You know, going from 140 people to 450 people, you'd need a whole new facility. You'd need a lot more staff. So money is going to be the big issue here. The provincial government is holding on to $10 million it got from the federal government to help deal with the fentanyl crisis. They haven't spent it yet, and the mayor is urging them to use that money to do this.
That's our time with Stephen Quinn, who hosts CBC Radio's On the Coast, and we're always happy to talk with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information.